between India and the US, I think it's fair to say. You graduated from Tata Institute, is that right, in 1976? And then after a short stay at Hyderabad and at Imperial College, you actually went to the US. And I think this was a decisive moment for you because you came to meet Bill Sutherland at University of Utah, where you stayed for a couple of years. And then you decided to go back to India, if I'm not mistaken, where you stayed several years. But finally, the great Bell Labs attracted you, and you moved back to the US, spent many years in Bell Labs, which, as everybody knows, I guess, was at that time one of the meccas, if not the mecca, of condensed matter physics, both theory and experiments, where so many great things were discovered. I think this is where I met you for the first time, or in some linear combination of Bell Labs and Princeton University. Then, after Bell Labs, you decided to try again being a professor in India. You went back to Bangalore, where you were a professor at the Indian Institute of Science for several years, maybe 7 or 9, I forgot.
Nine.
And then, finally, you went back again to the US, where you have been a professor in Santa Cruz for more than 10 years now, I think. So, all this being said, the interests in physics of them are very broad, and as I mentioned, they range from integrable systems to strongly correlated electron models, strongly correlated electron materials, thermoelectrics, and recently, in the past 5 or 6 years, you've been developing a whole new theoretical approach to deal with the very basic problem of strong correlations in somehow the strongest limit of strong correlation, which is essentially very, very large U-limit of the Hubbard model. And this is the topic to which these lectures are actually devoted. So we are going to have two lectures. The first series of two is today, and the last series of two is on April 9. If I understand correctly, today's session is devoted to setting up the formalism and explaining all the many theoretical advances in this formalism with new perspectives. And the one next time, on April 9, will be more devoted to experimental consequences, in particular for line shapes in ARPES. So this was a bit of a long introduction, but I think this was appropriate to welcome our speaker, and I leave you the floor now.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you, Antoine, for a very wonderful welcome. I'm delighted to be back in Paris. So today, this talk is for 2 hours, and we actually need to have a protocol for how to do these 2 hours. We can do 45 minutes or 50 minutes, break a little bit, and come back. Is that a good idea, you think? Yeah. So we'll do like 50 minutes, take some questions, and then we will reconvene after 5 minutes. So in this series of talks, I'm going to talk about a way to tackle very strong correlations, in fact, extreme correlations. And I should really begin by acknowledging my colleagues, friends, and inspirers. I've been fortunate to have a very large number of collaborators here, and many of them are in this room. Edward is here, and of course, Antoine is here. I should also say that this entire line of thought is influenced heavily by Phil Anderson. I don't think Phil agrees with the final results that I have in any sense, but that's usual. He has been very influential in getting me to think about this problem again. I had at some point decided it was too hard and it was too messy and walked away. I was doing other things. But then about 5, 6 years ago, he said, no, this is a good time for you to really go back and take a hard look. So which is what I did. And I should say that in the problem of strong correlations, Anderson has been a very strong critic of perturbation theory and weak coupling theories, which seem to dominate the discussion in the community. So he has written this rather sarcastic and in a way very factual critique of the way condensed matter was going in 2000, and basically Feynman diagrams, and go and look up the book by Abrikosov, Gorkov, and Dalashinsky for any many body problem that you have, and that should really contain the technique for doing that. And the belief was that you should just have to apply diagrams and some, you know, different classes of diagrams. So as I recall, well, in the last few years, the things that I have been developing have been influenced to a large extent by Schwinger. And there is the real danger of getting Phil to write one more article saying brainwashed by Schwinger and the tyranny of Schwinger's equations. It turns out that a lot of the developments that I have to discuss to you today are based on Schwinger's equations. They're also rather formidable. They're a completely different line. They get you much further, but indeed at some point it becomes tyrannical. So we need to find a pedagogical middle ground, and that's what I was lucky enough to find a very nice way to understand this new formalism, and going back almost by historical Poincaré cycle of some sort. Between Feynman and Schwinger, there's always Dyson. And it turns out the best way to understand this formalism is in terms of a non-Hermitian theory. And this is due to a particular representation of Goodswiller projected electrons, which I will describe to you in a few minutes. The only thing is, you don't have a tyranny anymore, but you do have an inconvenience of dealing with non-Hermitian quantum mechanics. This is something that we're not so worried about, because after all, in finite temperature field theory, we are used to dealing with non-Hermitian quantum field theory. So this is relatively a small price to pay for getting some real understanding of things. So I want to take a few minutes and tell you about what's been happening in this field. There have been lots of papers, and I should organize them in a certain way. So these lines basically tell you how I have been thinking about these things. And these numbers are basically how I'm going to present them. I'm actually going to present things in a very non-chronological sense. I'm going to talk about something very simple, which came very recently, as a way to understand a lot of things. But let me say that the code word ECFL stands for Extremely Correlated Fermi Liquids. So this is originally based upon a Schwinger-Dyson way of looking at the TJ model. And I'm actually going to begin by discussing a point that Antoine mentioned in the beginning, the Hubbard model and the TJ model. These are, of course, related. And the thing is, there is a tactical advantage in starting with the TJ model as opposed to the Hubbard model. You have actually done one level of renormalization already. We send U to a very large number, and you're dealing with the residual scales. And this is what Anderson had been talking all along. So the TJ model is a particularly useful starting point for understanding very strong correlations. And of course, this leads us immediately into difficulties. We have electrons which are no longer simple electrons. They are non-canonical objects. And roughly speaking, the relationship between these non-canonical TJ model electrons and the canonical electrons is parallel to the relationship between spins and bosons in Bose-boson theory. We know that spins are, after all, almost bosons, but not quite. They're not quite bosons because the boson commutation relations are non-canonical, and they produce a set of difficulties that, you know, were the center of attention in the 50s and 60s and up to the 70s. And it's in that connection that Dyson-Maliev representation was discovered. So it's very interesting that the whole game seems to replay in a different field, but somehow the progression of ideas has a very close parallel. So this is where one begins, and fundamental to this approach is a way of looking at the propagators in the very strong correlation problem. So in other words, we are not going to do the standard things that many of you might have seen before, like slave bosons and slave fermions. They are actually, I'm going to make some critical remarks about them later on. So I really want to go back and look at the propagators anew and see how exactly do we think about electron propagators in correlated systems, strongly correlated systems. And these are, after all, of great interest, because when we do photo emission, we're looking at the spectral function, which is just the imaginary part of the propagator. So what's the structural nature of the propagators? So it turns out that Dyson again dominated the whole discourse. We all always think of a propagator as having a single Dyson self-energy. So it turns out that a non-Dysonian representation pops out as a very natural consequence of looking at the Schwinger-Dyson equations, and this is characterized by two self-energies. And that's quite rigorous and very simple to see once you begin to think about this from this point of view. And this needs to be developed to give us practical results that we can compare with numerical stuff, or say the Hubbard model calculations, a la DMFT, or experiments, or whatever. So this is a starting ground, and we need to go from here to some practical results. And here there are many ways of doing it, and two approaches which seem very promising are out here. There is something called the lambda expansion. It's a bit like a virial expansion in the density of particles, except we are doing a quantum field theory, so we typically end up doing perturbation in a parameter rather than a density. So this parameter lambda, I'm going to introduce in a few minutes. And the other thing you could do is, starting with this two self-energy representation of the Green's functions, you can do a low frequency expansion of this. And this, of course, requires certain insight, which is available only after you've worked some way through here. But indeed, the motivation for this was really a conversation with Antoine. Antoine forced me one day, 3 years ago, 2 years ago, he said, look, let's just look at the low frequency results of your formalism. So this is strongly motivated by my friends here in Paris. And this leads to, actually, most of the interesting results already pop out if you do a low frequency expansion, assuming that the two self energies are themselves somehow almost Fermi liquids. And in any case, to get back to this story, there is this lambda expansion requires understanding of a particular invariance of the TJ model, which has not been noticed before. I mean, it's known in principle, but it has never been realized to be an important constraint. And this is something called shift identities. And these give you a clue of how to do a systematic lambda expansion. And these shift identities also tell you the problems with slave bosons and slave fermions. And they also lead to a second chemical potential in this problem, which is forced upon you by trying to enforce the shift identities. So all of these things come together, and they give us some really interesting checks on experiments and even predictions for experiments. So we have several things we can do in this box. There is a comparison with DMFT, which has been very, very profitable. I'm going to talk about that not too much today, but maybe in the next lecture I'm going to begin with the details of that. Then we also have comparison with the single impurity Anderson model, where again you can let U become very, very large. So that gets into the extreme correlation regime. And then we can also look at comparisons with high temperature series in the hopping of the TJ model. That's a very difficult expansion, and it has not been done to high orders previously, but motivated by this new set of results, our group has pushed very hard, and some of the main actors are in fact in the room. Edward has really done some amazing new formalism for high temperature expansion, but Walter Metzner indeed had a very useful formalism already. So this is something that we can compare with. And then the experiments. And this is really largely going to be in the next lecture. I'm going to talk about the angle result photo emission line shapes, and this will give me an opportunity to compare and also talk a little bit about the way Phil Anderson has been thinking about line shapes. So there is a set of papers by Phil about a couple of years ago, and the one qualitative feature that comes out without too much calculation. It's nice that, you know, there's a nice strong calculation on the one hand, but on the other hand, its consequences are very physical, and you can see them almost readily without even bothering to calculate things. You see that the line shapes have asymmetry, very strong asymmetries of a particular type. And these asymmetries, in fact, are very close to what you see in experiment. And there's some remarkably successful comparisons with experiments that I'm going to talk about here. And then I'm going to also talk about the so-called kinks in ARPES. It's a field of very active interest. And there are two kinds of kinks, the high-energy kink and the low-energy kink. And I'll talk about these in the next lecture. And then, of course, very recently, in fact, almost like 4 or 5 months ago, I realized that a lot of this formal work can be short-circuited, and you can understand the structure of things by using a Dyson-Maliev representation of correlated electrons. So I'm going to actually begin with this today. And finally, I hope that we get to this last box. It's got open issues. In fact, these are issues that I hope that we can work with Antoine and company in the next few months that I'm in Paris. So there's some progress on the superconducting phase. So these are things which are in progress. Is it the tradition to ask questions at the end or the beginning? Or the
there's no tradition. I would encourage everybody to ask questions during the talk.
I think that's a very good idea. I'm sure there are already some questions.
But, you know, in France you don't get so many questions.
Okay. You should trigger them. Can I provoke questions?
Sure.
Making wrong statements, for example, or that's dangerous. I'm not going to do that, but feel free to. Okay. So just to give you an idea of the sort of the effort, there's a whole lot of papers which have been written in the last 3 years. There's one set which is on the formalism aspect. And this really began the whole game in 2011. And this is really the last paper which I'm going to begin with pedagogically today. And I just want to flash this, not expecting you to read the titles, but we'll at some point come back and talk about these papers in detail. And there are these benchmarking papers. You have this formalism on the one hand. How do you know that this makes any sense? So you have to compare them with other things, other reliable information, other reliable knowledge. And in fact, we've been very fortunate to have a handshake with DMFT, with Antoine and his colleagues, and the Anderson impurity model, which is again, of course, a classic problem going back to Ken Wilson and Krishnamurthy and John Wilkins, where there are exact renormalization group results known for this problem, and we can compare the first set of results from this new formalism with this very sophisticated RG spectral functions, and I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And high T expansion is comparing these results with high temperature expansions of the TJ model. And then finally, we have a bunch of experimentally relevant papers. So there is one paper which basically emphasizes this particle hole asymmetry, and this is the first paper where we compared the line shapes with data, and this is rather remarkably successful. And a continuation of this is another paper written by my experimental colleague Gehong Guion and his student Kazue, and it's really more or less a similar story but in much greater detail, and they compare the MDCs and also the EDCs. And then I'll talk a little bit about this in my lectures itself, the low energy kinks. And this will give us an opportunity to talk about the Anderson KC papers. And this in turn is built upon the X-ray edge singularity ideas, which originated in fact with Philippe Nozière and De Dominicis, and Duniak and Sunjic later picked up those ideas. And Phil Anderson has been taking these X-ray ideas and implementing them in the normal ARPES of electrons with rather successful fits, I must say. Okay, so the setting for this, for these talks, and this is a pedagogical set of lectures. I don't want to give you all the details, but what I'm hoping to give you is the key ideas which are used in these long papers to do the various calculations. But some of the key ideas are in fact understandable without much detail, and I'm going to isolate them and talk about them. So we're going to talk about the setting first. So we have several papers on the ground state, which, you know, relatively speaking is a simpler problem than the problem of excitations. I mean, you might say, well, the ground state is not really simple in strong correlations. And I would agree it's not simple. But relatively speaking, if I want to understand the excitation spectrum of a strongly correlated system, that's a much harder problem than to understand the nature of the various ground states, the various broken symmetries. And in fact, a lot of people have been spending much time on understanding, you know, superconductivity from repulsive interactions. This is, for example, a very nice paper, and Laughlin himself has also been working on various competing phases, and Laughlin has produced several of the competing phases by using nothing more than what he calls as Hartree-Fock, but it's not quite Hartree-Fock. It's a very sophisticated and tricky version of Hartree-Fock. But indeed, this class of studies is about the ground state properties, and I'm not going to talk about that at all. I'm really interested in the liquid phase. I'm talking about something like a Fermi liquid or a non-Fermi liquid. And so we are trying to understand finite temperature, finite Q omega phases, and we need to understand ARPES and NMR, etc. And okay, the idea is the TJ model is perhaps a better starting point, because even if the Hubbard U is not very, very large, the ratio of U to Z becomes extremely large, where Z is the quasi-particle renormalization as you approach half filling. And I should begin with a rather well-known picture of the spectral weight in a Mott-Hubbard system. This I'm sure that you've seen in Paris many times. So this is the Hubbard model density of states of the renormalized propagator. It has basically a weight of n by 2 in the upper Hubbard band, which is at the energy scale of U. And at moderate energies, independent of U, we have the Fermi energy somewhere here. And the weight here is partitioned in this very nice way of n by 2 and 1 minus n, which I'm going to call as delta. And the Hubbard model, of course, describes all three pieces. And that's what makes it so much harder than the TJ model. So the argument is that the TJ model is perhaps a simpler model because it throws away this bunch of states and is dealing only with the low energy states. Of course, it throws away states, but to do it in a controlled way is rather non-trivial. So this is what is eliminated by Godzilla projection. And theoretically speaking, we have to deal with these projected electrons, which John Hubbard introduced this rather formidable notation. X's are basically the electron operators. X sub I is an electron operator at site I. And at the site I, we have three possible states. Either we have no electron, a down electron, or an up electron. And we can write the projection operator, which takes us from, let us say, 0 to down, which would be a creation operator, etc. So the X's are a code form for electron operators with hats on them. So there's this hat business here. The hatted electrons are not the simple electrons. The simple electrons are canonical. Their anticommutator is 1 or 0. And these hatted objects contain this 1 minus n down kind of a factor. And of course, the physics of this is fundamental to extreme correlations. In extreme correlations, the name of the game is you can take out any electron without any restriction, but to put in an electron, you make sure that the opposite spin of that electron is not already present at that site. In other words, you create, you look before you leap. Before you put in a particle, you make sure it's an empty site. So that's those factors. And these hatted fermions are called the X's, and you know, the electrons do the usual thing, they hop, and then there is the J part, which you can rewrite in this language. And the thing we take away from John Hubbard's work is the anticommutator of the X's is not a C number, but involves another X. So this X here with two sigmas is like a density. And so the anticommutator of the creation and the destruction operator is a constant plus a density. And this density arises from this Goetz-Wheeler constraint. So it's a mathematical coding of the Goetz-Wheeler constraint. And here you already see some resemblance to the spins versus bosons. The spin commutation relations, as you know, are of course the angular momentum commutation relations. They're not equal to 1 on the right. It's a Lie algebra. And that's what really these guys are. This is a graded Lie algebra. So extreme correlations, the nomenclature is meant to distinguish between weak, intermediate, and strong. I think this categorization has sort of exhausted itself. I don't think it really captures the kinds of things we're talking about. So for that reason, we introduce one more name, extreme correlations, where U is much, much bigger than T. And the claim is that several physical systems belong to this category, and they require this new way of thinking about them. So the TJ model from the Hubbard, this is the journey, and you get an extremely correlated model. And of course, you can have the same thing for a single impurity as well. So I want to begin by summarizing one very simple idea which comes out of this entire set of calculations. You see, we talked about brainwashed by Feynman or brainwashed by Dyson, for example. We always think about the propagator as being characterized by a single self energy. And that's indeed correct, and you cannot really argue with that. It's certainly, by inversion, you can always find a sigma given a G. But, and it's also what comes out of most field theories with a Wicks theorem. But then you have these strong coupling theories in which there is no Wicks theorem. And there is the problem that the real part of the Dyson self energy grows with omega. And this happens over a restricted range of frequencies, of course, when U is very big and omega is smaller than U, but much bigger than zero, the self energy grows linearly with omega. So that's in the TJ model, of course, this grows indefinitely because U has gone up to infinity. So that becomes a very difficult thing to deal with. And there are two ways of approaching the representations. You can do something called the Dyson-Mori representation, where you pull out the coefficient of omega and put it up here. And this sigma Dyson-Mori is the propagator which you get after rearrangement. And this is well behaved at high frequencies. And this is something you can do. It's what people obtain from moments analysis and stuff like that. But in this extremely correlated Fermi liquid representation, you find in a very simple and a natural way, this propagator has a representation in terms of two self energies. There's one guy here in the denominator, and there's one psi, which is in the numerator. And if you wish, you can think of this as little g as simply this guy and multiplied by this factor mu, which contains the numerator. So this is, I'm going to justify this in a few minutes. I'm going to tell you why this comes about, why this is a very natural thing to happen. But the thing to understand is that a lot of the action is really a consequence of this very simple form. This is a new form, and this form, of course, helps you to reconstruct the Dyson self-energy. You can always reconstruct the Dyson self-energy given this pair because, as I said, given a G, you can always invert and find a sigma. So you can always do this. You can reconstruct either the Dyson moiré or the Dyson self-energy. But the interesting thing is that, and this comes from the lambda expansion, which I haven't told you about, but what happens is both these guys, both these self-energies, to low orders in this parameter lambda, look exactly like the perturbative Fermi self-energies of the Hubbard model type of field theory. So both these guys have GGG kind of propagators, and these are very much like Fermi liquids. And these interaction lines are no longer the U, but there are some combinations of T and J. So these lines correspond to T and J in some sense. And of course, phi is an energy, it has dimensions of energy, and psi, which is sitting at the top, is dimensionless. So it basically has the same structure, but with one of the interaction lines replaced by one. The dummy line is like a drone interaction. So take all the self-energy diagrams of a field theory and replace one of them, the topmost one, by a drone line. In other words, just don't write the factor corresponding to the interaction. So that gives you dimensionally the right thing. And indeed, it'll turn out that from the phase space arguments, there's a self-consistent argument a la Abrikosov and Kolotnikov. We can make the same old phase space argument, which says the imaginary parts of both these self-energies go like T squared or like omega squared. So that's the self-consistent argument. And we will substantiate all of these claims in calculations. But I think it's a good idea to tell you right away that this is what things are. So this is a little list of my grievances with the TJ model, why it's so hard. Well, I mean, there's no small parameter. You have to invent a small parameter if you really want to, but a priori, there is no small parameter in that. And the projection is a singular perturbation, and you know. So the ECFL approach uses the Schwinger method to bypass the Wicks theorem and uses some extra time-dependent potentials to generate the equations of motion. And using the freedom of the Schwinger-Dyson method, together with these shift identities that I mentioned a few minutes ago, and the spectral sum rules, we can construct an alternate theory. Connects with Dyson-Maliev, as I said. And finally, I should say that this methodology gives us analytical results, which are very complementary to the numerical many-body work, which is in which, you know, Paris is leading, thanks to Antoine and group, and also indeed some other bridges can be built. You can talk about experimental consequences, and you know, this is a theory which has predictions, so that makes it already worthwhile. Okay. Any questions? So, this is.
So yeah. You're going to explain in more details this Dyson moiré.
Yeah. I'm going to talk about the Dyson moiré. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm going to explain the Dyson moiré, or the Dyson Maliev formalism.
Yeah,
I'm going to explain that in a very few minutes. So, this is actually my next task. I'm really going to do this. Explain to you why this Dyson-Maliev representation comes about, why this, there's a new way of looking at Goodswiller projected electrons, which can be thought of as removing a hat. I'll explain that in a minute. So this object that we work with is a propagator, where A is an action, which is an extra action in addition to the Hamiltonian, where you have a time-dependent potential which couples to the spin and charge densities. And the C hat is the same as the X operator. It's the projected electron. And this is, of course, the denominator just to normalize stuff. And this is like destruction operator. This is a creation operator. This is the familiar electron propagator, right? Now, there is a, I really couldn't find the originator of this representation. This goes back to maybe even John Hubbard himself. But there's a double hack theorem, which says the creation operator and the destruction operator require hacks. So take a C with a hat, and the hat corresponds to really putting in this look before you leap factor. You know, create a particle after making sure that the opposite spin is missing. And likewise for the destruction operator. And the densities don't require any of these projection operators because the densities retain the number of particles at a given site. Either you flip a spin or just count the number of particles. So this doesn't require C's. So this is the well-known double hack theorem for representing these Goodswiller projected electrons. The hats are on both C hat and both creation and the destruction operators. So in a minute, I'm going to show you that I can remove the hat from the destruction operator. This is, in fact, all there is to it. So there is very effective and a simple theorem which says, provided you put in a Goodswiller projector at the initial time in the propagators, you can just do away with the hat for the destruction operator. And I'm going to show this in a minute. This is basically a very beautiful property of upper triangular matrices, products of upper triangular matrices giving you back upper triangular matrices. This is really a very beautiful little result, but it's a rigorous result and tells you that you can remove the hats from the destruction operators. And once you do that, you end up with a non-Hermitian theory because these two guys are basically Hermitian conjugates of each other. But in the representation, they're not conjugates of each other. So you have an intrinsically non-Hermitian way of looking at things. And this helps.
Here, the argument is that you can only do that on one of the guys, right?
You can only do it on one of them. And you can only do it on the destruction operator. So this, in fact, also knocks out the particle hole symmetry in a way. You can't do this for both destruction and creation operators. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, so it was on state Fermat.
Yeah.
You almost keep, but there is something
small. That's a very good question. The claim is this is rigorous, because this is rigorous provided the set of states that you're acting upon are projected. In other words, these are not operator identities, but these are true to how's the word for it? So these are not operator identities standing alone without wave functions on either side. And nor are they expectation value identities. They're something in between. They're of the type that Dyson invented for spins. Basically, these are exactly true provided they're multiplied on the right by wave functions, which are in the physical subspace.
It's not exact. It's not exact.
It's exact in that subspace. And the claim is that you can calculate all your propagators within that subspace. Right. So you are indeed correct. So this is goes to the heart of the problem. It's a useful representation, provided you take care and have. So Dyson, in fact, had the Dyson projection operator in the beginning of the states. So in fact, the Dyson projection operator becomes the Goodswiller projection operator in this problem. So there's exact mapping between these two guys.
But so, am I correct that the intuitive picture is that if I start from an initial state, which satisfies the constraint on each side, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't have any double frequency.
Right.
And then I look at the time evolution.
Yes.
The fact that I keep
Yes.
Means that you can never create a double.
Correct.
And so,
and the claim is that when you begin with a exactly.
But you cannot keep local constraints when you compute it.
No, but if, no, I understand technically it's very hard to implement the local constraint at each time slice. We don't know that, otherwise we would have a different job. But but that's the content of this theorem.
This is indeed the content of the content of the theorem besides that.
You don't create the local constraints.
Right.
So you don't have to worry about C, about the structure.
That's correct. That's correct. So exactly right. So in the path integral representation,
it doesn't buy you the solution of the problem.
No, it doesn't buy you the solution of the problem, but gives you structural insight, which actually matches the Schwinger equations. That's what I'm going to say. That actually, this provides you with it recasts the goal of the calculation in a language which already tells you what the solution might look like, you know, without giving you the actual solution. You have to, of course, do something else to get the real solution, and we'll do that too. So as a pedagogical device, this is very useful. It's an exact reformulation in terms of, okay, but I think we are a little bit ahead of ourselves, huh? Because this is exactly what I'm going to talk about in a minute. So we want to compute this propagator, and this propagator, if you believe this theorem, and I'm going to prove this theorem in a minute, and in fact, Antoine has already given us a physical answer why this theorem must be true, and I'm sure most of you already see it too, but we'll do that systematically once. It's nice to do that. So if you buy this theorem, then of course this propagator can be expressed as an unhatted destruction operator and a hatted creation operator. And the hatted operator is two pieces, the creation and creation with a n. So this splits into two parts, and this gives us, in fact, a lot of things that we are looking for. And the claim is that if I define a trace property with an effective Hamiltonian and a time ordering, and put in the Goodsiller projector at the most initial time. So in other words, the Goodsiller projector is wrapped around in this time ordering. It is always pinned at the most initial time. Then it takes an arbitrary state and filters out all the double occupancy and leaves you behind with singly occupied states. And this whole product, including the effective Hamiltonian, preserve this property of being in the single occupied space. So this leads to a very straightforward path integral representation with the Goodsiller projector at only the initial time. So this action and also the effective Hamiltonian have, again, the property that you can write the creation operator with a hat and the destruction operator without a hat. So it gets rid of certain redundancy in the double hat representation. And this lack of redundancy gives you the most compact, exact formulae, which Schwinger's equations give you anyway. So this actually gives you the mapping. Okay, so let me give you a little proof of this upper triangular representation. So what we're trying to do is, in the TJ basis, we have, for example, a path integral or a partition function or something. We have an initial state with a prime, which belongs to the correct Hilbert space. It doesn't have any double occupancy. And these Q primes are a string of operators, which are, for example, the exponentials of time times the TJ Hamiltonian. And obviously, these guys retain the state within the physical space, and the final state is, without any question, automatically in the TJ subspace, if you can do this multiplication. Now, the problem of canonical embedding is the following. Canonical embedding says we take states which have partially physical components and partially unphysical components. And the Goodsiller projector basically is a 1 on the upper block and a 0 everywhere else. So we get physical states by taking these guys and acting with P on them. So in this canonical basis, we can express all the operators of interest in the following block structure. There is the upper block, which is the physical to physical. Then you have the unphysical to unphysical, unphysical to physical, and physical to unphysical. So every operator has this 2x2 blocking property. So the problem is the following. The problem is, if I begin with a canonical basis state, which does not, you know, which contains a bit of the unphysical states as well, I remove them with P of G. So now this guy is a physical state, and I multiply them by a string of these operators. What do I have to do such that the final state is still physical? Because I don't really want to go in and insert projection operators at all time slices. That makes it an impossible problem to do. So you really want to do it at least at one time and then hope that this constraint propagates in time t. And this has two classes of solutions, actually. So one class of solutions is basically through slave bosons. And here you require that Qs commute with a good Schiller projection operator. And in fact, Nick Reed and Dennis Nunes were perhaps one of the early people who recognized how to implement this constraint. And this conservation property was actually very beautifully exploited by these guys in the Anderson impurity problem. And you see that this commutation relation requires both of these off-diagonal elements to vanish. Okay? And now we're going to claim that a much better solution is simply to require that this commutator, when acting upon the projection operator, gives you zero. And this requires only the vanishing of QUP. It just kills this guy and leaves all these three intact. So how does this work? Well, if I take this constraint, then our Qs are of this form with a zero here, and you have an upper triangular matrix. And then what we're doing is we're taking a string of upper triangular matrices, which are acting upon a state with a killed lower component. So basically, the product of upper triangular matrices is upper triangular, and therefore, this proof works. So it's a very simple and very nice thing. And physically, as Antoine said a few minutes ago, the real heart of this theorem is that when I take a state which is already Goodswiller projected, if I destroy a particle, then I don't have to worry about Goodswiller projection because I'm taking out an electron and I couldn't possibly be creating a double occupancy. Whereas if I'm trying to create a particle, then I have to worry about it. So that's really all there is to it. But it's nice, it's formal, it's exact. So once you understand that, our task becomes very nice, very simple actually. This propagator can be written as, so let me remind you that C hat is C dagger times this, 1 minus n. So I plug that in here and I get two parts to this. And this is of course the decomposition of the physical Green's function into two terms by just separating out these two guys. And you can now define, if you like, an auxiliary Green's function, which is CC dagger without the n. And of course, in the time evolution of the intermediate states of this object, you do dabble with some double occupancy. Okay? So the auxiliary Green's function is a mysterious object in some sense. Mathematically, it's mysterious, but mathematically, it's exact. I mean, it's something you can define precisely. And the thing is, when you combine it with this together, you're guaranteed that there is no, that you recover the physical Green's function. So here what I'm doing is writing this part, CC dagger n, the disconnected part of this. I'm writing this as a matrix convolution of this auxiliary G with some sort of a self-energy. So basically, the second self-energy is born in this step here. It's basically the G inverse, little g inverse, acting on this four-point thing. So it's exactly the way you define a self-energy in the Hubbard model, for example, with the difference that there is no energy multiplying this. In a Hubbard model, you'd get a U here. So this is mathematically identical to the self-energy without an energy scale. So it's like this drone interaction that I mentioned a minute ago. You have like an interaction line. One interaction has got a factor one. You know, it conserve energy and momentum, but don't write any energy factor for that.
It almost looks like if we were to neglect small g,
yeah,
we would be recovering more or less the simplest mean field based on slip boson approach, right? We would have doping.
Yeah, I mean, it's 1 minus n sigma bar, right? So the average of that is n by 2 rather than n. So it's not quite that. Yeah. Okay. So at this point, we reassemble the whole things, and the notorious caparison factor is born here. You write the Green's function then as the convolution of a little g, which is this guy, times mu. And mu is a caparison function which sort of combines this 1 minus n in size. So this n comes from the average value of nf bar, which we just discussed is n by 2. So this is basically a consequence of this particular Dyson-Maliev kind of representation. Yeah.
I will get two, it is not called usually self-energy in the series of decoupling, but polarization operators or something like this, closer to one in the numerator, and another one in the denominator, it's usually in the series of the spin, but which you are right completely, is the same.
Indeed, this is correct. I mean, in fact, I'm going to show later that way back in 1975, there is this monster paper by Halperin and Hohenberg, when they were working out the time-dependent propagators of the spin problem. And they, in fact, wrote down exactly this caparison factor, too. So in fact, it's very difficult to invent something completely new. You may do something new in a given context, but then you look around, then you find that, there are many people who have thought about related problems, you know. So indeed, your comment is absolutely correct.
Okay, but why you need to leave from the initial X operators and to introduce the fermions, the two fermions, to remain this head, and so on, if you could start with the equation of motion, get, I don't know, maybe the same.
Yeah. I think what you're telling me is that the structure of this doesn't surprise you. You sort of think this is very natural, and I completely agree with that. It's just that I never believed this. I mean, I used to do this in the old days. I could never quite, maybe the one thing we're adding now, post facto, after all this work, is some confidence that this is really the most minimal and most useful way of describing the things. And indeed, we should be able to find much less involved ways of getting the answer. Once you see it, it really has to be understandable in simpler ways. And I think we are heading towards that phase two of this problem, you know. Yeah. So in phase one, really, my own crisis with this problem was I had thought about this for nearly 20 years, and I could never believe most things that I was doing. In a way, there was no, very difficult to have control parameters, very difficult to have some sense of when something is exact. So today we have reached, with the lambda expansion and with all these comparisons, some level of confidence about that. So we are really revisiting this problem, and maybe we are presenting things as completely new, but Shakespeare said, there's nothing new under the sun. Maybe some names are new. This factor mu, which multiplies g, I gave it a name for which a lot of people have asked me, why did I call it the caparison factor? I come from India, which speaks English language, which was of the 19th century. English language has not evolved too much in India. It's a bit like French in Canada. So this fact, the name caparison is very commonly used in India to talk about elaborate decoration. So the idea that I'm trying to convey here is that the fully renormalized propagator suffers two types of renormalizations. One is the little g, which is the auxiliary Green's function, is already a Fermi liquid. It's got all the renormalizations that the Fermi liquid has, okay? But in addition, you have something at the top. This is the self-energy in the numerator that I was talking about. It's like an adaptive spectral weight. Basically, it's sort of adjusting the spectral weight at high frequencies and compensating things at low frequencies. The second layer of dressing, which reminds me of the word caparison. So the word caparison is sort of meant in that sense. It's 5 o'clock. Maybe this is a... let's see. Okay, let me just talk to Dyson-Maliev and then we can stop, yeah. Okay? So let me just complete the Dyson-Maliev comparison. As I mentioned, Freeman Dyson way back in 1955 proposed that spins be represented in terms of bosons. A spin creation is in terms of Bose creation operator with a 1 minus n by 2s. And the destruction operator is a destruction operator without any factor. So these two are indeed exactly like the x operators that I have here. The number operator has precise analogy, and the Dyson projection operator, which you need the path integral representation, has perfect analogy with the Godzilla projector. And I want to anticipate a little bit of the progress in the lectures. In the spin problem, there is this semi-classical parameter, 1 by 2s. So when spin goes to infinity, you have classical spins. So there's indeed the range of 1 over 2s is between 0 and 1. And quite interestingly, in the Fermi problem also, we will find that there is a parameter lambda which interpolates between 0 and 1 and takes you from a Fermi gas to the fully correlated Fermi gas at the other end. And there is this really massive paper of Harris, Kumar, Halperin, and Hornberg, which worked out self-energies in this problem, and they really look almost exactly like what I'm talking about here. And indeed, that's precisely what the Halperin-Hornberg paper did. They were trying to compute the lifetime of the magnons by an expansion in 1 by 2s, because to leading order, the spin waves are infinitely infinite lifetime. And then their lifetime is finite because of the 1 over 2s thing. Maybe this is a good time to break, but before you go, I want to say something about the difficulty of creating something completely new. We call this as the Dyson-Maliev transformation, and this is indeed the first time it's appeared in physics literature is due to Freeman Dyson's monumental work on the spin waves. But indeed, if you go back and look at Hermann Weyl's description of angular momenta, Hermann Weyl already has precisely this representation in terms of partial derivative operators. So, I mean, even Dyson was not really new. I mean, it was really going back to Hermann Weyl, and maybe Hermann Weyl goes back even further. I don't know. I haven't checked. So indeed, it's very hard to create something completely new under the sun, but we try. Okay, so we break for 5 minutes.